Hello, and welcome to a new edition of the Capital Confidential podcast. This is Brendan Lyons, managing editor with the Times Union, and I'm joined today by Emily Munson, our Washington, D.C. correspondent, and Ed McKinley, a member of our Capital News team in Albany. Emily, yesterday was one of the most extraordinary and disturbing days in the nation's capital in quite a long time, probably since the British burned it, maybe. So what are some of the insight that you had as far as the protesters start moving toward the capital, and then, you know, they begin overtaking the chambers and breaking into the building? What was going on inside that you've learned about where some of the lawmakers were and how they were suddenly dealing with the approaching mob?
So, Brendan, I was not at the Capitol yesterday, but here's what I know about what unfolded from talking to many lawmakers, watching the events unfold on C-SPAN, and following the news all day like everyone has been. President Donald Trump, as you pointed out, had his rally around 11 a.m.
Today is not the end. It's just the beginning.
And from there, the protesters moved down the National Mall towards the U.S. Capitol and basically surrounded the building. And lawmakers were looking outside and hearing that the crowds were growing outside, and the noise could, you know, was kind of building around the building. And then were able to actually breach the building and make their way inside using some windows and doors that are down on the first floor. They basically overwhelmed the presence of Capitol Police who were surrounding the building. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I was watching C-SPAN, and I was watching the Senate debate certifying the Electoral College results.
My challenge today is not about the good people of Arizona.
And all of a sudden, a staff aide goes up to the senator who was at the dais.
We'll pause.
Protesters are in the building.
Thank you.
The mic caught the words of the aide saying, "The protesters are in the building." It was a really dramatic moment. And from there, both the Senate and the House chambers were locked down. Now, most senators were inside the Senate chamber, along with a bunch of press, and they essentially locked every single door of that building, had Capitol Police inside, and put an armed Capitol Police officer with a machine gun to stand between Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York, right in the middle of the chamber there. On the House side, a very similar thing was happening. There were fewer lawmakers in the chamber, but one of the lawmakers who was in the chamber was Paul Tonko, a representative for the Capital Region. And he was on an upper level gallery. Lawmakers were all spread out in the House chamber so that they could social distance for COVID reasons. And when protesters breached the building, the Capitol Police locked the outside doors of that chamber as well, locking all the members in. Protesters actually went to that chamber first and started banging on the doors. They even broke the glass of these windows that are on the doors. For some reason, the Capitol Police, I guess, couldn't find the keys to lock some of the doors. This is what I've heard from lawmakers. Yeah. They had to push furniture in front of the doors, tables and chairs, to form physical blockades to keep the protesters out. And they stood there with their guns drawn. And those are the really dramatic pictures that you've seen. And so that was really scary from the lawmakers I've spoken to. I've interviewed two lawmakers who were in that House chamber with Paul Tonko. Paul Tonko has not agreed to do interviews about the experience yet. But the two other lawmakers who were in there told me that it was extremely dramatic. They could hear the protesters banging on the doors. They heard a shot fired. And so the Capitol Police told them, hit the ground. They lay down on the floor between the seats of the chamber. And then after a few minutes passed, the Capitol Police really want to get the lawmakers out of there. And so they started to move them slowly across the room, across this upper gallery that goes around the outside of the room towards one of the upper doors. They were able to get the lawmakers out of that door. They had to walk past protesters who were lying on the floor with Capitol Police pointing their guns at them and down a back staircase of the Capitol. From there, they were moved through tunnels down to a large conference room that has no windows or doors. It's down in the bowel of the Capitol. And about 200 House lawmakers were held in that space for hours. A similar thing happened over on the Senate side where Senator Gillibrand and Senator Schumer were.
Then we were rushed out of the chamber, out of the back door, through the halls.
Senator Gillibrand was whisked through the tunnels of the Capitol with other members of the Senate to another secure room where she was held for hours.
So we then sat in this room for, I think, 4 hours. It was a long time.
Leadership, I believe, like Senator Schumer, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senator McConnell, leadership, I believe, were removed to another location. And basically, lawmakers waited for hours while protesters swarmed the building.
Have the Capitol Police taken some heat for not anticipating this better, not being better prepared, having, you know, even a wall of police to try to head off them as they ascended the Capitol?
Yes, there has been a lot of criticism of law enforcement to go around, and it's not just Capitol Police. It's criticism of Mayor Bowser and the preparations that she made with local police, the conversations that she had with the Pentagon about when to bring in the National Guard. Lawmakers today are demanding investigations over why these protesters were able to penetrate the building, and they want explanations from the National Guard about why it took them hours to get there, why Capitol Police were able to be overwhelmed so easily, why there were not more reinforcements present. These are all questions that they want answers to.
I think it's going to go deeper because when you have events like this, the FBI, other police agencies, they have intelligence officers, investigators who are in these groups, who are undercover, even if they're not a sworn member, they're in there milling about trying to learn, okay, what's going on. We saw that here in Albany yesterday where there was a violent demonstration and there was in fact an undercover state police investigator who was in that giving real-time reports to the state police at our Capitol. You just have to wonder why there wasn't a call to arms quicker there. I think there was a report I heard yesterday that initially on the National Guard, there was concern about the optics of how it would look having an armed force on the Capitol against in the face of protesters. But, you know, it did seem that once doors started being smashed and people started getting shot and were endangered, that there should have been a quicker mobilization. It certainly taught us yesterday that what we see in the movies isn't necessarily how quickly Washington can mobilize to protect its own Capitol.
And I think it's fair to point out the New York Times and others have reported that President Trump did not directly mobilize the National Guard, that the acting Secretary of Defense did so after consulting with the White House counsel and with the vice president instead of the president. And then I think it's also significant to contrast the decision to delay the mobilization of the National Guard while the U.S. Capitol was under siege versus how protesters were treated over the summer in front of the White House when tear gas was deployed on peaceful protesters to clear them out so that the president could take a photo op holding a Bible in front of a church, and his decision to send, you know, federal troops to Portland and other U.S. cities over the year. So it's interesting that in some cases when the protesters perhaps were more likely to be Democratic, the president has been criticized for being quick to use federal troops or not being shy about using force to break up protests. But when there's a violent riot at the U.S. Capitol during a key governmental process, there was a significant delay.
It does seem to be politicized often, doesn't it? From each side, how they view the protests that are in favor or, you know, against them, or what those protests are for. And as we're no longer called them rioters, but protests that turn violent. Well, there seems to be more of that, unfortunately, yesterday. And
there's one aspect of this story that was reported yesterday that, frankly, I've been very surprised has not been, you know, in the top three paragraphs of every news story about this and mentioned every time they talk about it in CNN. But there was a pipe bomb found at the RNC yesterday and a suspicious package found at the DNC, which to me is frightening because it implies a degree of organization to this. And I think that that's very significant, that this was not, you know, just a spontaneous people going over here to protest and then they just decide to bust into the Capitol because they're so caught up in the heat of the moment. But there was people pictured there with zip ties walking around in military gear. There were bombs found at the political headquarters, which I mean, if they were going to storm the Capitol, they must have figured that they would evacuate people. That would be the logical place that lawmakers would be sent, would be the DNC or the RNC. So it certainly suggests a degree of coordination that is frankly chilling.
And an intelligence breakdown.
Definitely. We knew this was coming. There was information being shared on Parler and Gab, which are social media platforms, for days ahead of this, you know, talking about the rally and preparations for Washington. And as it was ongoing, people on those platforms were sharing that they had weapons, sharing that they were intent on getting into the Capitol, that they had gotten into the Capitol. This was not a surprise, and it definitely could have been better prepared for.
And for listeners who have never been to the U.S. Capitol, it is not like the White House, where it is set up with big metal fences on the outside where it could basically withstand a siege. It's a place where people are coming in and out off the street every day. So it's sort of set up so that if a couple hostile people are trying to get in, there are security checkpoints for them to stop it. But if they were planning to stop a crowd of people that are trying to bust in, there should have been way more police there. They should have set up way more barricades, and those were just nowhere to be seen. So I think it's definitely raises a lot of questions about the intelligence and about the planning ahead of something like this.
We are going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
If you're enjoying Capital Confidential, be sure to check out its sister podcast, The Eagle. I'm Jessica Marshall. Join me each week as we take a look inside the newsroom at the Times Union, the Capital Region's oldest and largest newspaper. We'll discuss the week's top stories, and we'll talk to the award-winning reporters who write them. Listen at timesunion.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Capital Confidential podcast. We had a little taste of violent protest in the city of Albany yesterday at the state capitol in New York as well. Take us into what's happening at the Capitol, why it was a significant day for Albany.
So yesterday was the first day of the 2021 legislative session. A number of the lawmakers were present. There was remote capabilities, but the Senate gaveled in at about 12:30 p.m. just after lunch. They held some procedural votes. And at the very same time, the governor was holding a coronavirus briefing, talking about the news of the day, talking about the COVID rates, talking about vaccine distribution and about his upcoming state of the state. And while this is going on, much like in the U.S. Capitol, while the lawmakers are doing the people's business, just outside, there's a protest and there's a small group of Proud Boys who the FBI has designated as an extremist right-wing group. And they're met by an extremist left-wing group of the Antifa, loose coalition of the anti-fascist anarchist groups. There's a fight between them and one of the Antifa rioters stabs two of the Proud Boys protesters.
They started gathering around 10 a.m. It was a Stop the Steal protest. So it was kind of coordinated with the Washington protest. And they were supposed to kick off around noon. And just before noon, at some point, several people, four or five, who are known members or, you know, followers of Antifa, the police know them, the Proud Boys, some of them even in statements that we saw, knew who these individuals were. So you have a group of about 30 Trump supporters gathered
with bullhorns and a microphone to try to give a speech of sorts. Antifa people arrive, only about five or six of them, and they, according to the, there was an undercover police officer watching everything unfold, and even knew who some of these members are, knew them by face, knew them by name, and saw the instigation begin by the Antifa members who were trying to antagonize the other side, Proud Boys, and in a couple, there was a couple skirmishes leading up to the stabbings. And then at some point, an individual, a 37-year-old man who on Facebook posts is shown participating in Antifa activities, similar activities around, you know, around the nation, up and down the East Coast seaboard, including he had reported being arrested on his Facebook page at Trump's inauguration in 2017. And so this individual is now charged with first degree assault because one of the men he's alleged to have stabbed in the chest and in the leg suffered minor injuries. The second person was stabbed in the bowel and had to undergo emergency surgery, and it's considered very serious, this injury. But what was startling to me a little bit was that you had this unprecedented violence I haven't seen in my time at the Capitol for years, where I've seen protests and I've seen people shout at one another, but I've never seen someone attacked in this level of violence occur. It's kind of underscoring, I think, the way things are going nationwide. But our New York lawmakers have remained, for the most part, completely silent on this. They almost all put out statements yesterday condemning the violence in Washington, as they should, but left out what was occurring right under their windows. Literally, you know, the governor's on the second floor in the Red Room giving a briefing that overlooks the park where this violence was unfolding beneath him. And it was kind of surprising to me. But going back to Washington, Emily.
What happened at the U.S. Capitol yesterday was an insurrection against the United States incited by President Trump.
What do you think will become of the calls for the president to resign or the president to be removed under the 25th Amendment? Is there even time to do that? Maybe there isn't enough time to remove him.
It depends on the method of removal, how much time you might need to complete it. As you've mentioned, there are growing calls at the Capitol that Trump should be either impeached again or he should be removed from office via the 25th Amendment, which allows the vice president and the president's cabinet to decide to remove him if he is unable to complete his duties.
It's fair to say that Democrats have certainly been leading the charge on this, with Pelosi and Schumer coming out for it.
And so I believe the president is dangerous and should not hold office one day longer.
There's also been a number of Republicans who have spoken up, the Republican governor of Vermont, Mark Kelly, the former chief of staff, just said that he believed that this was a step that should be taken. And there's been a number of resignations from within the administration for people that said they didn't want to be a part of it, including Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, who's actually married to Mitch McConnell. But interestingly, it would require 25th Amendment would require a majority of the cabinet. So if they're losing out people who are resigning because they don't want to be a part of it, they are not going to be participating in any vote that would potentially remove Trump from office. So it could happen very quickly, but it would need to be organized very quickly as well.
Certainly. And I think this is probably on a world stage changed our look a little, wouldn't you say, Emily, in terms of how other countries must be looking at the United States right now and wondering what makes you so great? What makes you so different? Seeing something like this unfold that you know, everyone, I think, in large part may have thought wouldn't come to this.
That's true. So many lawmakers, and particularly people who are involved in the foreign policy sphere, have observed that this is behavior that you usually see in other countries that don't have a strong several hundred year democracy like ours. We're supposed to be a beacon of democracy around the world. And when individuals can't accept the result of an election and are willing to perpetrate acts of violence upon their place of government in order to try to assert their will, that's contrary to American values. lawmakers all across the political spectrum have been saying that again and again over the past couple of days. It feels like a couple of days. It's been some very long days.
When the protesters were, you know, finally brought under control, you know, they regained control of the Capitol as well. As many people thought would happen, Congress resumed their business, which I think in part was also a way to send a message.
We started to figure out the protocols of what would it take to get back into the Senate chamber. We thought about doing the voting right where we were. We could have put on C-SPAN in this room, but we decided just to wait a little longer to get back into the chamber, and that would be, frankly, retaking our chamber and showing that our democracy survives despite violent insurrection.
And talk a little bit about how that unfolded, and overnight, I believe, as you watched it unfold.
That's correct. Lawmakers were determined to get back to certifying the results of the presidential election because they wanted to show that violence was not going to take them off course. So after several hours, when the US Capitol had been cleared of rioters and other people who had come into the building and it was cleaned up a little bit, more law enforcement had arrived to secure the area. At that point, lawmakers were able to emerge from their secure holding locations, and they went back to their chambers, the House and Senate chamber, and they resumed the discussion and debate over the certification of the election. Essentially, the way the process went was Vice President Pence would read out each state and to which candidate they had assigned their electors. And then lawmakers had the opportunity to object. And if there were House members and at least one Senate member who objected, then there would be a full debate over that objection and a vote over whether it would be sustained. That happened with Arizona and also Pennsylvania. And there were many hours of debate when they finally did resume this at around 8:30 p.m. The whole process took around 7 hours until about 3 a.m. for them to wrap up. Among the objecting lawmakers were some New Yorkers.
Tens of millions of Americans are concerned that the 2020 election featured unconstitutional overreach by unelected state officials and judges ignoring state election laws. We can and we should peacefully and respectfully discuss these concerns.
Including U.S. Rep. Elise Stefanik, Nicole Malliotakis, Lee Zeldin, and Chris Jacobs. Basically, their argument was that millions of Americans had questions about this election. They believe there had been irregularities in the way it was conducted in some states. And so they said they wanted to have a debate about that in Congress, that they wanted to discuss it, and they wanted to consider reforms to the elections. Now, a lot of the irregularities that they were describing have not been sustained in courts, and courts have not found proof of election fraud occurring in the 2020 election. But these are the arguments that they made on the floor of the House.
Thank you for listening to our latest edition of the Capitol Confidential podcast, and to both Emily and Ed for joining us today. Also, please note that audio from Washington, D.C. that was used for this podcast was provided courtesy of C-SPAN.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.